This is Financial Standard, the definitive source of news, thought leadership and analysis for Australian wealth management professionals. Financial Standard, take the lead.
Hi, welcome to the Financial Standard podcast. My name is Matthew Wai, and I am journalist at Financial Standard. American exceptionalism is an ideology that has been around for a prolonged period of time, separating America from other societies for its unique, distinctive, and exemplary elements. However, at this day and age, how has this definition transformed? More specifically, in a contemporary climate, how does it play into investors' behavior? Today, we have Daniel Martin, Senior Investment Analyst at Alvia Asset Partners. Thanks so much for being with us, Daniel.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
So let's get right into it. Even though it's been talked a lot, what exactly is US exceptionalism?
Your introduction highlighted it very well. It's not a new concept. It's not something that's a new phenomenon. I mean, the US has been exceptional since it really started back in the 1800s. You have 200 years of a country that's navigated the economy to become a powerhouse today. But what it really is today is it's about the US share market when people are referencing US exceptionalism. So the funny thing I always enjoy is the term US exceptionalism is a great example of where the finance industry looks to consolidate a really deep and complex topic into the equivalent of a soundbite. Now, I'm frankly disappointed we haven't been able to come up with an acronym for it yet, you know, like EBIT or EBITDA. It's just something we happen to do. But the aura of exceptionalism has really been fueled by the consistent relative strength of the US to the globe. So when I say that, I'm saying from 2011 to now, sort of end of 2024, the S&P 500 became 5.5 times the size of the MSCI World when you take out the US, you know, reaching an all-time high on a relative valuation. The US represents 70% of the MSCI universe, the highest any country has ever hit, ever since they've been tracking it. You know, it has been the place for investors to be. And I want to take you back to sort of the start of 2024. I mean, you came into 2024 and we saw consumer confidence deteriorating, pressures of shrinkflation, cost of living crisis. You know, it's a very common topic around here in Australia, especially with the upcoming election. You know, near negative savings rates across the globe. There were two wars being fought. You had government debt. You had, what, half the world go to an election process. Questions around if a recession would occur during the year. And through all that playing out last year, the S&P 500 delivers 23% for investors, fueled by the idea that it is the epicenter of innovation. You know, a performance that, to some investors, cemented it as the place to invest because it was able to navigate all of this and continue to compound, creating this almost aura of invincibility that is the US share market, and that is US exceptionalism.
I would like to talk about, you know, with how distinctive this American exceptionalism is, how does politics play in part in terms of aiding or tempering that ideology?
It's a good question. I mean, the first thing about investments is irrespective of where your starting valuation is today, investment markets don't like future uncertainty, nor do they like spontaneity of unexpected decisions. I'll set up a framework first, and then we'll walk through what has probably been the most topical point of 2025 thus far. And again, this is me doing the typical thing where I'm consolidating down a very deep and complex topic and trying to simplify it as best I can. So I think stage one in any sort of political decision is there's an immediate reaction from the market. So it's a risk on or risk off event. And this is not because of the event that's occurring, but it's because of the deviation from consensus. Okay, so that's an important point to understand. It's not because of something occurring, it's a deviation from the consensus of that occurring. Stage two is then we cycle through aftershocks. So how other stakeholders will respond? What are other externalities that no one was able to foresee in these decisions and policies? And then stage three, we sort of go to the longer term impacts. What are these? Like, this isn't known for some time and thus elevates the level of uncertainty that exists. You know, markets can't or shouldn't control policies, merely make judgments on the impacts they have. And then the influence of politics is then how much that is important for the globe is reflected by your portion of, quite frankly, economic GDP. So the US is a great example, 26% of the GDP. So their policies are far more important for the global stage than the policies of, you know, for example, Australia. As much as it pains me to say that, it's probably true. So we'll take Liberation Day then. It's probably the most topical point of 2025 thus far. So, and I'll try and walk you through the framework as best I can. So, you know, coming in, so stage one, tariffs were known. We knew they were coming. The consensus was that it was going to be core geographies. So China, Mexico, Japan, Canada, and the EU bloc would all face higher tariffs. So that's the consensus view. And then Donald Trump lifts up his board and we go, this is a lot more than just a few countries. This is a broad brush approach of 10%. And some other countries, which no one expected tariffs, all of a sudden have tariffs, like Vietnam at 46%. Yeah? That's a large deviation from the consensus. So that's something not factored in by the market, and that's a negative impact. The other part is that you have to understand the investment world for years coming out of COVID had spent all this time and money in trying to diversify the manufacturing base across Asia. So moving away from China, coming into the Liberation Day, no one thought that, oh, we'll be fine because our production is, you know, located in Vietnam, who actually happened to receive quite a large tariff. So the initial reaction, negative impact. You know, a fallout is largely expected. The extent of this is unknown. And we even haven't had steps two and three play out. I mean, just this morning, Donald Trump walked back the decision tariffs exist as a 90-day rest. But you could see in the lead up to that decision from Donald, there was aftershocks occurring with countries responding and replying, China fighting back with other tariffs, other countries coming to meet, and to know what the actual end engagement would have been, that's rather uncertain. And that's what markets don't like. It creates effectively a scenario where investors go, okay, we can't forecast this, we can't understand this, so we'll step from the market, we'll sit on the sideline and we'll wait. And then you see movements like this morning where Trump goes, we're going to roll back the tariffs, and the NASDAQ finishes up 12%, with that basically being vertical from halfway through the trading period when they change that. That's the impact of politics. It's uncertainty that it creates.
So, you know, mentioning about how politics, you know, has such a huge impact in the markets, what other elements have the same or, you know, around the same impact to the markets? Is there any other similar elements that you could explain?
Yeah, other elements that could impact the market. I mean, it's the big one really is you can have euphoria come through, and this was probably the big thing for us that we saw coming at the back end of last year. So euphoric investors. And this goes back to the first question of US exceptionalism. You know, the US was a consensus long, like to start this year, long AI, your returns will be far superior to other investment opportunities. You know, the irony is, if we go back to the start of 2024, Wall Street strategists were bearish. They actually, throughout the year, had to up their price targets for the S&P 500. You know, we came off a strong 2023 and they felt the steam had to come out of it. And I don't think this is a function of forecasting ability. I think this is a function of how difficult it is to actually understand where the market's going. You know, coming into 2025, the consensus became S&P 500 does 13%. Now, this is your question was around how do other factors influence the market? 2023 was a stellar year. Everyone was like, steam has to come out of the market coming into 2024. That didn't occur. 23% year in the S&P 500. Now all the consensus view has shifted and it's a consensus long. So that's a market sentiment shift. And that is one of the bigger factors that I think are underappreciated that can really influence the market. The risk from this, you know, because it's one thing to talk about returns, it's another thing to talk about risk. And the risk from this is it's when you have such a consensus view, we think investor ill discipline creeps in. You know, investors work to justify why the market is trading above a 90th percentile relative to history. You know, we can get into a conversation around, and more capital exists today than ever has. So maybe trading against medians aren't a fair representation. But you can't dispute that the expectations were high coming into this year. And then you see investors go, well, I was too defensive coming into 2024. It was a great year. It's a consensus long. I'm going to shift away from my defensive asset classes because I've seen the S&P 500 navigate last year. And now I'm just going to have success, basically. That's kind of the risks we see and we don't like. I mean, for us, really, the three things I saw at the back end of last year that were really interesting that I don't think were spoken about a lot. Margin debt being used by individual investors was at an all-time high. Daily expiring options reached an all-time high at the back end of last year. So that's speculation in the market. And we saw some NFT volumes. Now, everyone talks about crypto, but remember, crypto and NFTs were kind of tied at the hip in that first sort of 2021 rally. We saw NFT volumes quietly move sort of 400% in 30 days, you know, closing out 2024. There was a collection of these pudgy penguins. Yeah, it's just an animated penguin that looks cute. Market value is sitting at 780 million. You know, there are companies on the ASX that are, you know, less than 780 million, they produce earnings. So I'll leave that there. But really, the thing is it's sentiment that shifts, and any shocks or any externalities that occurred that move it from outside the norm bring mass volatility, bring mass market recalibration. Now, that's really a big thing that can move.
Finally, I want to talk about, you know, investor sentiment that you've mentioned earlier as well, but how would they navigate this uncertainty, and would they return to exploring American exceptionalism? And what about Australia, like Australian investors? How are they affected by this concept?
Yeah, we'll do that in two parts. I mean, the core of the US exceptionalism remains. So although I've said, you know, US exceptionalism was that the S&P 500 will navigate and do irrespective of what the globe does, the core of that remains. You know, it is actually the epicenter of innovation. There's no dispute on that, given what they've been able to produce and continue to do so. The consumer in the US, you know, will spend more than the consumer in Australia. It's just a function of that economy. But it's when you're coming from such a high base, that's where it's, you know, the concern. Like, are we willing to step in and underwrite the uncertainty here? You know, it's interesting, you know, from sort of up until 2024, I think if you go back to 2015 and go to 2024 in November, if you remove the Mag 7 from the US market performance of earnings, so we're talking earnings, you know, the other names in the US, their earnings growth was actually akin to Europe, ex the UK. So it's not like there was all these amazing companies underneath in the US that produced. It was sort of the Mag 7 did a lot of the driving. And then your question is, well, was it actually, you know, performance of the companies, or was it excess capital flows shifting multiples higher? So we'll put that to the side, and then we'll talk about Australia, and I'll sort of bring it back for you. So, I mean, touching on Australia, our market is obviously different to the US. You know, we've had a steep reliance on global growth. Like, we are a steep relier of global growth continuing. You know, we fuel that via the commodity sector. You know, and then we also have the significant reliance on our financials. You know, it's coming into 2025. I think it was one of the most reported topics was the Australian Big Five, we call it, because we like to include Macquarie, had a stellar run in 2024, and the price to book valuations were, you know, the highest of any business in the world. You know, the difference between Australia and the US is banks are highly capital intensive. You know, the typical companies that drove the US return are not so much capital intensive. And then the other point I want to touch on is, you know, the thing about the financials run up, it was really easy to sit back and say that's passive flows. So, you know, people just passively purchasing the ETS, passively purchasing the market. You know, BHP was the largest company on the ASX at the start of last year. It was down sort of 20, 22% last year. So that, I think that is a goes against the idea that it was just this passive buying mentality. What we think really drew the attention of investors was this perceived stability of earnings. and investors willing to reward this consistency with a high valuation. Now, the big five banks in Australia are quite a protected species of companies here locally. And the competition, although we like to investigate competition, we have, you know, not a lot of competition, a lot of sectors in the country. And the banks also distribute the Australian treasured return of a franked dividend. So, you know, that is a local favorite. So where to step back into today? How to think about investing today with knowing those backgrounds? You know, I find this funny. When it's bull markets, no one ever really wants to talk to investment analysts because everything's working, right? It's all going well. And I don't have to worry about trying to select names. I can just go into straight line ETFs and I'll be fine. But when the markets see a bit of turbulence, apparently I have all the good ideas and I have all the stocks that won't sell off. Now, you asked me this question 2 months ago. We'd be pushing defensive sectors, healthcare, gold, liquid investment grade bonds, listed REITs, not Goodman Group though, specifically in Australia. You know, there's concerns around the valuation of that and infrastructure. Geographically, Europe, UK, China, moving away from the US. Still holding US positions, but as I said, there was quite a high base of valuation and we would have been shifting to those other geographies. You know. And these aren't topics I'm saying in hindsight. Like, this is all published information on our website via the insights page. But today, the dynamics change. You know, it's about being selective. Being an active manager today will reward you. So we still think there are overvalued names around the globe, and you have to look pretty far and broad to try and find some. There are a few investments that can insulate you in a drawdown. There's not many. It's why I always believe a multi-asset approach is best. You know, it gives you time to deeply research in turbulent markets. So, you know, holding some defensive fixed income, holding some defensive alternatives gives me time to research and explore the US market. Why do we have so many names in the US that earnings have not grown? But the multiple has. You know, are these companies better than companies in the UK who trade at depressed multiples relative? It gives you time to research that, because as the US multiples come down, you can go, okay, but the earnings expectation moving forward might be greater. So you can research that. I think in Australia, I think healthcare is a really beaten up sector at the moment. I think it's been overlooked. There's plenty of noise, but it's a defensive sector. It's a defensive asset class. I was on AusBiz earlier in the year during reporting season, and I discussed Ramsay Health Care. I still think that holds from here. I still think, you know, having a stable compounding company in your portfolio is essential moving forward. You know, they have to navigate both internal and external headwinds. But if you look at where the valuation is today and you understand the debt profile and you understand what it does as a business, you can see it's quite defensive.
Those are all the questions I have for you today, Daniel. Thank you so much for your insight.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this Financial Standard podcast. For more information, visit financialstandard.com.au. Please keep in mind that the information discussed in this podcast is general in nature and does not consider personal circumstances. Reliance should not be placed on any content without further independent financial research and advice.